When they finished making love, she rested her head on his shoulder and he brushed a hair from her cheek, praying the next hour would go slowly. He hated the thought of her returning to the embassy that morning, as he knew she eventually must. He didn't want to share her with anybody. The room was now bathed in the morning sun, which only made him wonder when he'd next be allowed to spend a whole night with her. The head of interest section had been called straight back to Geneva on urgent business and had taken only one secretary with him, leaving Hannah in Paris on her own for the weekend. She only wished she could tell Simon what it was all about, so he could pass the information on to Kratz. She had double-locked her room and left the embassy compound by the fire escape. Hannah told him that she had felt like a schoolgirl creeping out of her dormitory to join a midnight feast. "Better than any feast I can remember," were his last words before they fell asleep in each other's arms. The day had begun when they had gone shopping together in the Boulevard Saint-Michel and bought clothes she couldn't wear and a tie he would never have considered before he met her. They'd had lunch at a corner cafe and taken 2 hours to eat a salad and drink a bottle of wine. They had strolled down the Champs-Élysées hand in hand, as lovers should, before joining the line to see the Clodion exhibition at the Louvre. A chance to teach her something he thought he knew about, only to find it was he who did the learning. He bought her a floppy tourist hat in the little shop at the base of the Eiffel Tower and was reminded that she always looked stunning whatever she wore. They had dinner at Maxim's, but only ate one course, as they both knew by then that all they really wanted to do was return to his little flat on the left bank. He remembered how he had stood there mesmerized as Hannah removed each garment until she became so embarrassed that she began to take off his clothes. It was almost as if he didn't want to make love to her because he hoped the anticipation might go on forever. Of all the women, including the occasional promiscuous student with whom he had had one-night stands, casual affairs, even sometimes what he had imagined was love, he had never known anything like this. And afterwards, he discovered something else he had never experienced before. The sheer joy of just lying in her arms was every bit as exhilarating as making love. His finger ran down the nape of her neck. "What time do you have to be back?" he asked, almost in a whisper. "1 minute before the ambassador." "And when's he expected?" "His flight's due in from Geneva at 11:20, so I'd better be at my desk before 12. "Then we still have time to make love once more," he said, as he placed a finger on her lips. She bit the finger gently. "Ow!" he said mockingly. "Only once?" she replied. Debbie brought the deputy ambassador through to Cavalli's office at 12:20. Neither man commented on the fact that Al-Obeidi was late. Cavalli indicated the chair on the other side of his desk and waited for the visitor to be seated. For the first time, he felt strangely uneasy about the Arab. "As I mentioned yesterday," Cavalli began, "we are now in possession of the document you require. We are therefore ready to exchange it for the sum agreed." "Ah, yes, the $90 million, said the Iraqi, placing the tips of his fingers together just below his chin while he considered his next statement. "Cash on delivery, if I remember correctly."
"You do," said Cavalli.
"So now all we need to know is where and when."
"We require the document to be delivered to Geneva by 12 o'clock next Tuesday. The recipient will be a Monsieur Pierre Dumont of the bankers Dumont et Cie."
"But that only gives me 6 days to find a safe route out of the country, and..."
"Your God created the world in that time, if I remember Genesis correctly. Such a fatuous story," added Al-Obeidi.
"The declaration will be in Geneva by Tuesday midday," said Cavalli.
"Good," said Al-Obeidi. "And if Monsieur Dumont is satisfied that the document is authentic, he has been given instructions to release the sum of $90 million by wire transfer to any bank of your choice in the world. If, on the other hand, you fail to deliver, or the document proves to be a fake, we will have lost $10 million, with nothing to show for it but a 3-minute film made by a world-famous director. In that eventuality, a package similar to this one will be posted to the director of the FBI and the commissioner of the IRS.
Al-Obeidi removed a thick envelope from his inside pocket and tossed it across the table. Cavalli's expression didn't change as the deputy ambassador rose, bowed, and walked out of the room without another word. Cavalli felt sure he was about to discover what "among other things" meant. He ripped open the bulky yellow envelope and allowed the contents to spill out onto his desk. Photographs, dozens of them, and documents with banknote serial numbers attached to them. He glanced at the photographs of himself in deep conversation with Al Calabrese on the sidewalk in front of the National Café, another of himself with Gino Sartori in the center of Freedom Plaza, and yet another with the director sitting on the dolly as they talked to the former deputy chief of the D.C. Police Department. Al-Obeidi had even taken a photograph of Rex Butterworth entering the Willard Hotel and of the actor, bald-headed, sitting in the third car, and later getting into the limo outside the archives loading dock. Cavalli began drumming his fingers on the table. It was then that he remembered the nagging doubt at the back of his mind. It was Al-Obeidi he had seen in the crowd the previous day. He had underestimated the Iraqi. Perhaps the time had come to call their man in Lebanon and inform him of the Swiss bank account he had opened in the deputy ambassador's name. No. That would have to wait until after the 90 million had been paid in full. "What do I do, Simon, if he offers me the job?" Scott hesitated. He had no idea what Mossad would expect her to do. He knew exactly what he wanted her to do. It was no use putting the question to Dexter Hutchins in Virginia because they wouldn't have hesitated to tell him to continue using Hannah for their own purposes. Hannah turned towards what Scott laughingly described as the kitchen. "Perhaps you could ask Colonel Kratz what I should do," she suggested when he didn't reply. "Explain to him that the ambassador wants me to take Muna's place, but that another problem has arisen."
"What's that?" asked Scott anxiously.
"The ambassador's term of office comes to an end early next month. He may well be asked to stay in Paris, but the chief administrator is telling everyone that he's going to be called back to Baghdad and promoted to deputy foreign minister." Scott still didn't offer an opinion. "What's the matter, Simon? Are you incapable of making a decision at this time in the morning?" Scott still said nothing. "You're just as pathetic on your feet as you are in bed," she teased. Scott decided the time had come to tell her everything. He wasn't going to wait another minute. He walked out of the kitchen, took her in his arms, and stroked her hair. "Hannah, I need to..." he began when the phone rang. He broke away to answer it. He listened for a few moments before saying to Dexter Hutchins, "Yes, sure, I'll call you back as soon as I've had time to think about it." What was the man doing up in the middle of the night, wondered Scott as he replaced the receiver. "Another lover, lover?" Hannah asked with a smile. "My publishers, wanting to know when the manuscript will be finished. It's already overdue."
"And what will your answer be?"
"I'm currently distracted."
"Only currently?" she said, pressing her finger on his nose.
"Well, perhaps permanently," he admitted. She kissed him gently on the cheek and whispered, "I must get back to the embassy, Simon. Don't come down with me, it's too risky."
He held her in his arms and wanted to protest, but settled for, "When will I see you again?"
"Whenever the ambassador's wife feels in need of a swim," Hannah said.
She broke away.
"But I'll keep on reminding her how good it is for her figure, and that perhaps she ought to be taking even more exercise."
She laughed and left without another word. Scott stood by the window, waiting for her to reappear. He hated the fact that he couldn't just phone, write, or make contact with her whenever he felt like it. He longed to send her flowers, letters, cards, and notes to let her know how much he loved her. Hannah ran out onto the sidewalk, a smile on her face. She looked up and blew Scott a kiss before she vanished around the corner. Another man, who was cold and tired from hours of waiting, also watched her. Not from a window in a warm room, but from a doorway on the opposite side of the road. The moment Scott disappeared from sight, the man stepped out of the shadows and followed the ambassador's second secretary back to the embassy compound.
Chapter 17.
"I don't believe you," she said.
I fear that the truth of the matter is you don't want to believe me, said Kratz, who had flown from London that morning.
But he can't be working for any enemy of Israel.
If that's the case, perhaps you can explain why he passed himself off as a Mossad agent.
For the last 2 hours, Hannah had tried to think of a logical reason why Simon would have deceived her, but had to admit that she had been unable to come up with a convincing answer.
"Have you told us everything you passed on to him?"
Kratz demanded.
"Yes," she said, suddenly feeling ashamed. "But have you checked with all the friendly agencies?"
"Of course we have," said Kratz. "No one in Paris has ever heard of the man. Not the French, not the British, and certainly not the CIA. Their head of station told me personally that they have never had anyone on their books called Simon Rosenthal.
So what will happen to me now? Asked Hannah.
Do you wish to continue working for your country?
You know I do, she said, glaring back at him.
And are you still hoping to be included in the team for Baghdad?
Yes, of course I am. Why would I have put myself through all this in the first place if I didn't want to be part of the final operation?
Then you will also want to abide by the oath you swore in the presence of your colleagues in Herzliya.
Nothing would make me break that oath. You know that. Just tell me what you expect me to do.
I expect you to kill Rosenthal.
Scott was delighted when Hannah confirmed on Thursday afternoon that she would be able to slip away for dinner on Friday evening, and might even find it possible to stay overnight. It seemed that the ambassador had been called away to Geneva again. Something big was happening, but she still couldn't find out exactly what. Scott had already decided that three things were going to take place when they next met. First, he would cook the meal himself, despite Hannah's comments about his inadequate kitchen. Second, he was going to tell her the truth about himself, whatever interruptions occurred. And third, Scott felt more relaxed than he had in weeks once he had decided to come clean, as his mother had described it whenever he'd tried to get away with something. He knew that he would be recalled to the States once he had informed Dexter of what had happened, and that a few weeks later he would be quietly discharged. But that was no longer of any significance. Because third, and most important of all, he was going to ask Hannah to come back to America with him, as his wife. Scott spent the afternoon shopping in the market for freshly baked bread, the finest wild mushrooms, succulent lamb chops, and tiny ripe oranges. He returned home to prepare a feast he hoped she would never forget. He had also prepared a speech he believed she would, in time, find possible to forgive. During the evening, Scott found himself looking up at the kitchen clock every few moments. He felt robbed if she was ever more than a few minutes late. She had failed to turn up for their previous meeting, though he accepted that she had no way of letting him know when something unexpected came up. He was relieved to see her walk through the door soon after the clock had struck 8. Scott smiled when Hannah removed her coat, and he saw she was wearing the dress he had chosen for her when they'd gone shopping together for the first time. A long blue dress that hung loosely off the shoulders and made her appear both elegant and sexy. He immediately took her in his arms and was surprised by her response. She seemed distant, almost cold. Or was he being oversensitive? Hannah broke away and stared at the table laid for two with its red and white check tablecloth and two sets of unmatching cutlery. Scott poured her a glass of the white wine he had selected to go with the first course before he disappeared into the kitchen to put the final touches to his culinary efforts, aware that he and Hannah always had so little time together.
"What are you cooking?" she asked, in a dull, flat voice.
"Wait and see," he replied. "But I can tell you, the starter is something I learned when..."
He stopped himself.
"Many years ago," he added rather lamely.
He didn't see her grimace at his failure to finish the original sentence.
Scott returned to join her a few moments later, carrying two plates of piping-hot wild mushrooms with a small slice of garlic bread. "But not too much garlic," he promised her, for obvious reasons. No witty or sharp response came flying back, and he wondered if she was unable to stay overnight. He might have questioned her more closely had he not been concentrating on the dinner as well as wanting to get his speech over with. "I wish we could get out of Paris and see Versailles, like normal people," said Scott as he dug his fork into a mushroom.
"That would be nice," she said.
"And even better..." She looked up and stared at him. "A weekend at the Coleman d'Or. I promised myself long ago when I first read The Life of Matisse that..." He hesitated once again, and she lowered her head. "And that's only France," he said, trying to recover. "We could take a lifetime over Italy. They have 100 Coleman d'Ors." He looked hopefully towards her, but her eyes remained staring at the half-empty plate. What had he done? Or was she fearful of telling him something? He dreaded the thought of learning that she was going to Baghdad when all he wanted to do was take her to Venice, Florence, and Rome. If it was Baghdad that was making her anxious, he would do everything in his power to change her mind. Scott cleared away the plates to return a few moments later with a succulent lamb Provençal. "Madame's favorite, if I remember correctly?" But he was rewarded only with a weak smile. "What is it, Hannah?" he asked as he took the seat opposite her. He leaned across to touch her hand, but she removed it quickly from the table. "I'm just a little tired," she replied unconvincingly. "It's been a long week." Scott tried to discuss her work, the theater, the Clodion exhibition at the Louvre, and even Clinton's attempts to bring the three living Beatles together. But with each new effort, he received the same bland response. They continued to eat in silence until his plate was empty. "And now we shall end on my pièce de résistance." He expected to be playfully chastised about his efforts as a chef. Instead, he received only the flicker of a smile and a distant, sad look from those dark, beautiful eyes. He disappeared into the kitchen and returned immediately carrying a bowl of freshly sliced oranges with a touch of Cointreau. He placed the delicate morsels in front of her, hoping they would change her mood. But while Scott continued with his monologue, Hannah remained an unreceptive audience.
Honor Among Thieves, Cassette 5.
He removed the bowls, his empty, hers hardly touched, and returned moments later with coffee, hers made exactly as she liked it, black with a touch of cream floating across the top, and no sugar. His, black, steaming, with too much sugar. Just as he sat down opposite her, determined this was the moment to tell her the truth, she asked for some sugar. Scott jumped up, somewhat surprised, returned to the kitchen, tipped some sugar into a bowl, grabbed a teaspoon, and came back to see her snapping closed her tiny evening bag. After he had sat down and placed the sugar on the table, he smiled at her. He had never seen such sadness in those eyes before. He poured them both a brandy, whirled his around the balloon, took a sip of his coffee, and then faced her. She hadn't touched her coffee or brandy, and the sugar she had asked for remained in the center of the table, its little mound undented. "Hannah," Scott began softly, "I have something important to tell you, and I wish I had told you a long time ago." He looked up to find her on the verge of tears. He would have asked her why, but feared that if he allowed her to change the subject, he might never tell her the truth. "My name is not Simon Rosenthal," he said quietly. Hannah looked surprised, but not in the way he had expected, more anxious than curious. He took another sip of coffee and then continued, "I have lied to you from the day we met, and the more deeply I fell in love with you, the more I lied." She didn't speak, for which he was grateful, because on this occasion, like his lectures, he needed to proceed without interruption. His throat began to feel a little dry, so he sipped his coffee again. "My name is Scott Bradley. I'm an American, but not from Chicago, as I told you when we first met. I'm from Denver. A puzzled look came into Hannah's eyes, but she still didn't interrupt him. Scott plowed on. I'm not Mossad's agent in Paris writing a travel book. Far from it, though I confess the truth is much stranger than the fiction. He held her hand, and this time she didn't try to remove it. Please let me explain, and then perhaps you'll find it in your heart to forgive me. His throat suddenly felt drier. He finished his coffee and quickly poured himself another cup, taking an extra teaspoonful of sugar. She still hadn't touched hers. I was born in Denver, where I went to school. My father was a local lawyer who ended up in jail for fraud. I was so ashamed that when my mother died, I took a post at Beirut University because I could no longer face anyone I knew. Hannah looked up, and her eyes began to show sympathy. It gave Scott the confidence to continue. I don't work for Mossad in any capacity, nor have I ever done so. Her lips formed a straight line. My real job is nowhere near as romantic as that. After Beirut, I returned to America to become a university professor. She looked mystified. And then her expression suddenly changed to one of anxiety. Oh, yes, he said, his words beginning to sound slightly slurred. This time I'm telling the truth. I teach constitutional law at Yale. Let's face it, no one would make up a story like that, he added, trying to laugh. He drank more coffee. It tasted less bitter than the first cup. But I am also what they call in the trade a part-time spy, and as it's turned out, not a very good one. Despite many years of training and lecturing other people on how it should be done. He paused. But that was only in the classroom. She looked more anxious. You need have no fears, he said, trying to reassure her. I work for the good side, though I suppose even that depends on where you're looking from. I'm currently a temporary field officer with the CIA. The CIA? She stammered in disbelief. But they told me... What did they tell you? He asked quickly. Nothing, she said, and lowered her head again. Had she already known about his background? Or perhaps guessed his original story didn't add up? He didn't care. All he wanted to do was tell the woman he loved everything about himself. No more lies, no more deceit, no more secrets. Well, as I'm confessing, I mustn't exaggerate, he continued. I go to Virginia 12 times a year to discuss with agents the problems they've faced while working in the field. I was full of bright ideas to assist them in the peace and comfort of Langley, but I'll treat them with more respect now that I've experienced some of the problems they come up against, especially having made such a mess of things myself. It can't be true, she said suddenly. Tell me you're making it up, Simon. I'm afraid not, Hannah. This time it's all true, he said. You must believe me. I only ended up in Paris after years of demanding to be tested in the field because, with all my theoretical knowledge, I assumed I'd be a whiz if they'd just gave me the chance to prove myself. Scott Bradley, professor of constitutional law, infallible in the eyes of his adoring students at Yale and the senior CIA operatives at Langley. There'll be no standing ovation after this performance. Of that we can both be sure. Hannah stood and stared down at him. Tell me it's not true, Simon, she said. It mustn't be true. Why did you choose me? Why me? He stood and took her in his arms. I didn't choose you. I fell in love with you. They chose me. My people needed to find out why Mossad had put you in the Jordanian embassy attached to the Iraqi interest section. He was finding it difficult to remain coherent and couldn't understand why he felt so sleepy. But why you? She asked, clinging to him for the first time that evening. Why not a regular CIA agent? Because
They wanted to put someone in, someone who wouldn't be recognized by any of the professionals. Oh, my God, who am I meant to believe? She said, breaking away. She stared helplessly at him. You can believe me because I'll prove all I've said is true. Scott began to move away from the table. He felt unsteady as he walked slowly over to the sideboard, bent down to pull open the bottom drawer, and after some rummaging around, removed a small leather case with the initials SB printed in gold on the top right-hand corner. He smiled, a triumphant smile, and turned back. He attempted to steady himself by resting one hand on the sideboard. He looked towards the blurred figure of the woman he loved, but could no longer see the desperate look on her face. He tried to remember how much he had already told her and how much she still needed to know. "Oh, my darling, what have I done?" she said, her eyes now pleading. "Nothing. It's all been my fault," said Scott. "But we'll have the rest of our lives to laugh about it. That, by the way, was a proposal. Feeble, I agree, but I couldn't love you any more than I do. You must surely realize that," he added as he tried to take a pace towards her. She stood staring at him helplessly as he lurched forward before attempting to take a second step. Then he tried again, but this time he stumbled and collapsed across the table, finally landing with a thud on the floor at her feet. "I can't blame you if you don't feel the same way as..." were his final words, as the leather case burst open, disgorging its contents all around a body that was suddenly still. Hannah fell on her knees and took his head in her hands. She began to sob uncontrollably. "I love you. Of course I love you, Simon, but why didn't you trust me enough to tell me the truth?" Her eyes rested on a small photo lodged between his fingers. She snatched it from his grasp. Written on the back were the words, "Catherine Bradley, summer 66. It must have been his mother. She grabbed the passport that lay by the side of his head and quickly turned the pages, trying to read through her tears. Male, date of birth, 11-7-56. Profession, university professor. She turned another page, and a photo from Paris Match fell out. She stared at herself, modeling an Ungaro suit from the spring collection of 1990.
No, don't let it be true," Hannah said as she lifted him back into her arms. "Let it be just more lies."
And then her eyes settled on the envelope simply addressed Hannah. She lowered his body gently to the ground, picked up the envelope and ripped it open. "My dearest Hannah, I have tried to think of 100 ways to begin this letter. There's one simple way. I love you. And, as important, I have never loved before. And now I know I can never love anyone like this again."
"No," she screamed. "No,"
almost unable to read his words through her tears. "You are not only my lover, but my closest friend. I'll never want or need anyone else ever again. I rejoice at the thought of spending the rest of my life with you, and wonder how I deserve to be so lucky."
"Please, God, no,"
she wept as her head fell on his chest.
"I love you too, Simon. I love you so much.
I want 3 daughters and 2 sons, and I must warn you that I won't settle for less. We'll discuss grandchildren later. I fear I'll be irascible and tiresome in old age, but I'll never stop loving you. Don't let's wait."
No,
Hannah cried as she bent down to kiss him. She suddenly leaped up and rushed over to the phone. She dialed 17 and screamed,
"Please, God, let one pill not be enough. Answer, answer, answer,"
she shrieked at the phone as the doors of Scott's apartment flew open. Hannah turned to see Kratz and another man whom she didn't recognize come bursting in.
She dropped the phone on the floor and ran towards them, throwing herself at Kratz and knocking him to the ground. "You bastard! You bastard!" she screamed. "You made me kill the only person I ever really loved. I hope you rot in hell," she said as her fists pumped down into his face. The unknown man moved quickly across and threw Hannah to one side before the two of them picked up Scott's limp body and carried him out of the room. Hannah lay in the corner, weeping. An hour passed, maybe two, before she crawled back to the table, opened her bag, and removed the second pill. Chapter 18. White House. Mr. Butterworth, please. There was a long silence. I don't show anyone by that name, sir. Just a moment, and I'll put you through to personnel. The archivist waited patiently, made aware as each second passed that the new telephone system ordered by the Clinton administration was clearly overdue. Personnel office, said a female voice. How can I help you?
I am trying to locate Mr. Rex Butterworth, special assistant to the president.
Who's calling?
Marshall, Calder Marshall, archivist.
Of?
Of the United States of America.
There was another long silence.
The name Butterworth rings no bells with me, sir, but I'm sure you realize there are more than 40 special and deputy assistants to the president.
No, I didn't realize, admitted Marshall. There followed another long silence.
According to our records, said the female voice, he seems to have returned to the Department of Commerce. He was a Schedule A, just here on temporary assignment.
Would you have a number where I might reach him?
No, I don't, but if you call the department locator at the Commerce Department, I'm sure they will find him for you.
Thank you for your help. Glad to have been of assistance, sir.
Hannah could never recall how long she had lain huddled up in the corner of Simon's room. She couldn't think of him as Scott. She would always think of him as Simon. An hour, possibly, two. Time no longer had any relevance for her. She could remember crawling back to the center of the room, avoiding overturned chairs and tables that would have looked more appropriate in a nightclub that had just experienced a drunken brawl. She removed the pill from her bag and flushed it down the toilet, the automatic action of any well-drilled agent. She then began to search among the debris for any photographs she could find and, of course, the letter addressed simply to Hannah. She stuffed these few mementos into her bag and tried, with the help of a fallen chair, to get back on her feet. Later that night, she lay in her bed at the embassy, staring up at the blank white ceiling, unable to recall her journey back, the route she had taken, or even if she had climbed the fire escape or entered by the front door. She wondered how many nights it would be before she managed to sleep for more than a few minutes at a time. How much time would have to pass before he wasn't her every other thought? She knew Mossad would want to take her out, hide her, protect her, as they saw it, until the French police had completed their investigation. Governments would have their diplomatic arms twisted up their diplomatic backs. The Americans would expect a lot in return for killing one of their agents, but eventually a bargain would be struck. Hannah Kopeck, Simon Rosenthal and Professor Scott Bradley would become closed files. For all three of them were numbers, interchangeable, dispensable, and, of course, replaceable. She wondered what they would do with his body, the body of the man she loved. An honorable but anonymous grave, she suspected. They would argue that it must be in the interest of the greater good. Wherever they buried him, she knew they would never allow her to find his grave. She wouldn't have dropped the pill in the coffee in the first place if Kratz hadn't talked again and again of the 39 scuds that had landed on the people of Israel, and in particular of the one which had killed her mother, her brother, and her sister. She might even have drawn back at the last moment if they hadn't threatened to carry out the job themselves, should she refuse. They promised her that if that was the case, it would be a far more unpleasant death.
Just as Hannah was about to take the first pill out of her bag, she had asked Simon for some sugar, one last lifeline. Why hadn't he grabbed at it? Why didn't he question her, tease her about her weight, do anything that would have made her have second thoughts? But then why? Why had he waited so long to tell her the truth? If he had only realized that she had things to tell him, too. The ambassador had been called back to Iraq, a promotion, he explained. He was, as Kanuk had been telling everyone, to become deputy foreign minister, which meant that in the absence of Mohammed Said al-Zahyaf, he would be working directly with Saddam Hussein. His place at the embassy was to be taken by a Hamid al-Obeidi, the number two at the United Nations, who had recently rendered some great service for Iraq, of which she would eventually learn. The ambassador had offered her the choice of remaining in Paris to serve under al-Obeidi or returning to Iraq and continuing to work with him. Only days before, Mossad would have considered such an offer an irresistible opportunity. Hannah so wanted to tell Simon that she no longer cared about Saddam that he had made it possible for her to overcome her hatred of the Scuds, even made the death of her family a wound that might in time be healed. She knew that she was no longer capable of killing anyone, as long as she had someone to live for. But now that Simon was dead, her desire for revenge was even stronger than before. Department of Commerce? Rex Butterworth, please. What agency? I'm not sure I understand, said the archivist. What agency is Mr. Butterworth with? Asked the operator, pronouncing each word slowly as if she were addressing a four-year-old. I have no idea, admitted the archivist. We don't show anyone by that name. But the White House told me... I don't care what the White House told you. If you don't know which agency, may I have the personnel office? Just a minute.
It turned out to be far longer than a minute.
Office of Personnel? This is Calder Marshall, Archivist of the United States. May I speak to the director?
I'm sorry, but he's not available. Would you like to speak to his executive assistant, Alex Wagner?
Yes, that would be just fine, said Marshall.
She's not in today. Could you call again tomorrow?
Yes, said Marshall with a sigh.
Glad to have been of assistance, sir. When Kratz's car screeched to a halt outside the Centre Cardiovasculaire in Bois Gilbert, there were three doctors, two orderlies, and a nurse waiting for them on the hospital steps. The embassy must have pulled out every stop. The two orderlies ran forward and lifted the body gently but firmly out of the back seat of the car, carrying Scott quickly up the steps before placing him on a waiting gurney. Even as the gurney was being wheeled down the corridor, the three doctors and the nurse surrounded the body and began their examination. The nurse quickly removed Scott's shirt and trousers while the first doctor opened his mouth to check his breathing. The second, a consultant, lowered his ear onto Scott's chest and tried to listen for a heartbeat, while the third checked his blood pressure. None of them looked hopeful. The consultant turned to the Mossad leader and said firmly, "Don't waste any time with lies. How did it happen?"
"We poisoned him, but he turned out not to be..."
"I'm not interested," he said. "What poison did you administer?"
"Ergot alkaloid," said Kratz.
The consultant switched his attention to one of his assistants. "Ring the hospital, Vidal, and get me details of its action and the correct antidote fast," he said as the orderlies crashed through the rubber doors and into a private operating theater. The first doctor had managed to keep Scott's mouth open during the short journey and create an airway. He had already pressed down the tongue to leave a clear passageway to the larynx. Once the gurney had come to a stop in the theater, he inserted a clear-angled plastic tube of about 5 inches in length to ensure the tongue could not be swallowed. The nurse then placed a mask over Scott's nose and mouth that was connected to an oxygen supply in the wall. Attached to the side of the mask was a rubber bag, which she began pumping regularly every 3 or 4 seconds with her left hand as she held his head steady with her right. Scott's lungs were immediately filled with oxygen. The consultant placed an ear over Scott's heart again. He could still hear nothing. He raised his head and nodded to an orderly who began rubbing paste on different parts of Scott's chest. Another nurse followed him, placing small electronic discs on the paste marks. The wires from the discs were connected to a heart monitor machine that stood on a table by the side of the gurney. The fine line that ran across the machine and registered the strength of the heartbeat produced a weak signal. The consultant smiled below his mask as the nurse continued to pump oxygen into the patient's mouth and nose. Suddenly, without warning, the heart machine gave out a piercing sound. Everyone in the operating room turned to face the monitor, which was now showing a thin, flat line running from one side of the screen to the other. "Cardiac arrest!" shouted the consultant. He jumped forward and placed the heel of his hand over Scott's sternum, and with both arms firmly locked, he began to rock backwards and forward as he tried to push a volume of blood from the heart to resuscitate his patient. Like a proficient weightlifter, he was able to pump away with his arms at a rate of 40 to 50 times a minute. An intern wheeled forward the defibrillator. The consultant placed two large electric clamps onto the front and side of Scott's chest. 200 joules, said the consultant. Stand clear. They all took a pace back as a shock was transferred from the electric discharge machine and ran through Scott's body. They stared at the monitor as the consultant jumped forward again and continued to pump Scott's chest with the palms of his hands. But the thin green line did not respond. 200 joules, stand clear, he repeated firmly, and they all stood back again to watch the effect of the electric shock. But the line remained obstinately flat. The consultant quickly returned to pumping Scott's chest with his hands. 360 joules, stand clear, said the consultant in desperation, but the nurse who raised the number on the dial knew the patient was already dead. The consultant pressed a button, and they all watched the highest shock allowed pass through Scott's body, assuming that must be the end. They turned their attention to the monitor. "We've lost him," was on the consultant's lips, when to their astonishment they saw the line begin to show a faint flicker. He leaped forward and began pumping away with the palms of his hands as the flicker continued to show irregular fibrillation. 360 joules, stand clear, he said once again. The button was pressed, and their attention returned to the monitor. Fibrillation returned to a normal rhythm. The youngest doctor cheered. Another doctor rushed into the room and, facing his superior, said, "The antidote is GTN. The consultant quickly located a vein in Scott's left arm and jabbed a needle directly into it, leaving a cannula sticking out to which a saline drip was quickly attached. A nurse went straight over to the poisons cabinet and extracted a vial of glycerol trinitrate, which she passed to the consultant, who had a syringe ready. He extracted the blue liquid from the vial, shot a little into the air to be sure it was flowing freely, then pumped the antidote into a side valve of the intravenous drip. He turned to watch the monitor. The flicker maintained a constant rhythm. The consultant turned to the senior nurse and said, "Do you believe in miracles?" "No," she replied. "I'm a Jew. Miracles are only for Christians." Hannah began to form a plan. A plan that would brook no interference from Kratz. She had made the decision to accept the job as senior secretary to the ambassador and to accompany him back to Iraq. As the hours passed, her plan began to take shape. She was aware there would be problems, not from the Iraqi side, but from her own people. Hannah knew that she would have to circumvent Mossad's attempts to take her out, which meant that she could never leave the embassy, even for one moment, until the time came for the ambassador to return to Iraq. She would use all the techniques they had taught her over the past 2 years to defeat them. When she was in Iraq, Hannah would make herself indispensable to the ambassador, bide her time, and once she had achieved her objective, happily die a martyr's death. She had been left with only one purpose in life, now that Simon was dead: to assassinate Saddam Hussein. Department of Commerce. "Alex Wagner, please," said the archivist. "Who?" "Alex Wagner, Office of Personnel." "Just a minute." Another stretched minute. "Personnel? This is Calder Marshall, Archivist of the United States.
I called yesterday for Miss Wagner, and you told me to try again today.
I wasn't here yesterday, sir.
Well, it must have been one of your colleagues. Is Miss Wagner available?
Just a minute.
This time the archivist waited several minutes. Alex Wagner, said a brisk female voice.
Miss Wagner, my name is Calder Marshall. I'm the archivist of the United States, and it's extremely important that I contact Mr. Rex Butterworth, who was recently detailed to the White House by the Commerce Department.
Are you a former employer of Mr. Butterworth's? Asked the brisk voice.
No, I am not, replied Marshall.
Are you a relative?
No.
Then I'm afraid I cannot help you, Mr. Marshall.
Why is that? Asked the archivist.
Because the Privacy Act prohibits us from giving out any personal information about government employees.
Can you tell me the name of the Commerce Secretary, or is that covered by the Privacy Act, too?
The archivist asked.
Dick Fielding, said the voice abruptly. Thank you for your assistance, said the archivist.
The phone went dead. When Scott woke, his first memory was of Hannah. And then he slept. When he woke a second time, all he could make out were blurred figures who appeared to be bending over him. And then he slept. When he woke again, the blurs began to take some shape. Most of them seemed to be dressed in white. And then he slept. When he woke the next time, it was dark and he was alone. He felt so weak, so limp, as he tried to remember what had happened. And then he slept. When he woke, for the first time he could hear their voices. Soothing, gentle, but he couldn't make out the words, however hard he tried. And then he slept. When he woke again, they had propped him up in bed. They were trying to feed him a warm, tasteless liquid through a plastic straw. And then he slept. When he woke, a man in a long white coat with a stethoscope and a warm smile was asking in a pronounced accent, "Can you hear me?" He tried to nod, but fell asleep. When he woke, another doctor, this time he could see him clearly, was listening attentively as Scott attempted his first words.
"Hannah. Hannah,"
was all he said. And then he slept. He woke again, and an attractive woman with short, dark hair and a caring smile was leaning over him. He returned her smile and asked the time. It must have sounded strange to her, but he wanted to know. "It's a few minutes after 3 in the morning," the nurse told him.
"How long have I been here?"
he managed. "Just over a week, but you were so close to death. I think in English you have the expression touch and go. If your friends had been a moment..." And then he slept. When he woke, the doctor told Scott that when he'd first arrived, they thought it was too late. And twice he'd been pronounced technically dead. Antidotes and electrostimulation of the heart, combined with a rare determination to live and one nurse's theory that you might be a Gentile, defied the technical pronouncement, he declared with a smile. Scott asked if someone called Hannah had been to see him. The doctor checked the board at the end of his bed. There had been only 2 visitors that he was aware of, both of them men. They came every day. And then Scott slept. When he woke, the 2 men the doctor had mentioned were standing one on each side of his bed. Scott smiled at Dexter Hutchins, who was trying not to cry. "Grown men don't cry," he wanted to say, "especially when they work for the CIA. He turned to the other man. He had never seen a face so full of shame, so ridden with guilt, or eyes so red from not sleeping. Scott tried to ask what had caused him such unhappiness. And then he slept. When he woke, both men were still there, now resting on uncomfortable chairs, half asleep.
"Dexter,"
he whispered, and they both woke immediately.
"Where's Hannah?"
The other man, who Scott noticed was recovering from a black eye and a broken nose, took some time answering his question.
And then Scott slept, never wanting to wake again.
Chapter 19.
Department of Commerce. The director, please. Who's calling?
Marshall, Calder Marshall.
Is he expecting your call?
No, he is not.
Mr. Fielding only takes calls from people who have previously booked to speak to him.
What about his secretary? Asked Marshall.
She never takes calls.
So how do I get a booking with Mr. Fielding?
You have to speak to Miss Zalumsky in reservations.
Can I be put through to Miss Zalumsky, or do I have to make a reservation to speak to her as well?
There's no need to be sarcastic, sir. I'm only doing my job.
I'm sorry. Perhaps you'd put me through to Miss Zalumsky?
Marshall waited patiently.
Miss Zalumsky speaking.
I'd like to reserve a call to speak to Mr. Fielding.
Is it domestic, most favored status, or foreign? Asked a bored-sounding voice.
It's personal.
Does he know you?
No, he doesn't.
Then I can't help. I only deal with domestic, most favored status, or foreign.
The archivist hung up before Miss Zalumsky was given the chance to say, glad to have been of assistance, sir. Marshall tapped his fingers on the desk. The time had come to play by new rules. Cavalli had checked into the Hotel de la Paix in Geneva the previous evening. He had booked a modest suite overlooking the lake, neither expensive nor conspicuous. When he woke in the morning, he jumped out of bed, strolled across to the window, drew the curtains, and admired the fountain in the center of the lake, whose water spouted like a gushing well high into the air. He turned to see that an envelope had been pushed under the door. He tore it open to discover a note confirming his appointment to take tea with his banker, Monsieur Franchard, at 11 o'clock that morning. Cavalli was about to drop the card into the waste paper basket when he noticed some words scribbled on the bottom. I do hope you find the brand appropriate. Have a good party. N.V. After a light breakfast in his room, Cavalli packed his suitcase and suit bag before going downstairs. The doorman answered his questions in perfect English and confirmed the directions to Franchard-Récy. In Switzerland, hall porters know the location of banks, just as their London counterparts can direct you to theaters or football grounds. As Cavalli left the hotel and started the short walk to the bank, he couldn't help feeling something wasn't quite right. And then he realized that the streets were clean. The people he passed were well-dressed, sober, and silent, a contrast in every way to New York. Once he reached the front door of the bank, Cavalli pressed the discreet bell under the equally discreet brass plate announcing Franchard-Récy. A doorman responded to the call. Cavalli walked into a marble-pillared hall of perfect proportions.
Perhaps you would like to go straight to the 10th floor, Mr. Cavalli. I believe Monsieur Franchard is expecting you.
Cavalli had only entered the building twice before in his life. How did they manage it? And the porter turned out to be as good as his word, because when Cavalli stepped out of the elevator, the chairman of the bank was waiting there to greet him.
Good morning, Mr. Cavalli, he said. Shall we go to my office?
The chairman's office was a modest, tastefully decorated room, Swiss bankers not wishing to frighten away their customers with a show of conspicuous wealth. Cavalli was surprised to see a large brown parcel placed in the center of the boardroom table, giving no clue as to its contents.
This arrived for you this morning, the banker explained. I thought it might have something to do with our proposed meeting.
Cavalli smiled, leaned over, and pulled the parcel towards him. He quickly ripped off the brown paper covering to find a packing case with the words T:Boston stamped across it. With the help of a heavy silver letter opener, which he picked up from a side table, Cavalli prized the wooden lid slowly open. He didn't notice the slight grimace that came over the chairman's face. Cavalli stared inside. The top of the box was filled with styrofoam packing material, which he cupped out with his hands and scattered all over the boardroom table. The chairman quickly placed a waste paper basket by his side, which Cavalli ignored as he continued to dig into the box until he finally came to some objects wrapped in tissue paper. He removed a piece of the tissue paper to reveal a teacup in the Confederate colors of the First Congress. It took Cavalli several minutes to unwrap an entire tea set, which he laid out on the table in front of the puzzled banker. Once it was unpacked, Cavalli also appeared a little mystified. He dug into the box again and retrieved an envelope. He tore it open and began reading the contents out loud. "This is a copy of the famous tea set made in 1777 by Pearson and Son to commemorate the Boston Tea Party. Each set is accompanied by an authentic copy of the Declaration of Independence. Your set is number 20917 and has been recorded in our books under the name of J. Hancock." The letter had been signed and verified by the present chairman, H. William Pearson VI. Cavalli burst out laughing as he dug deeper into the wooden box, removing yet more packing material until he came across a thin plastic cylinder. He had to admire the way Nick Vicente had fooled the U.S. Customs into allowing him to export the original. The banker's expression remained one of bafflement. Cavalli placed the cylinder in the center of the table before going over in considerable detail how he wanted the meeting at 12 to be conducted. The banker nodded from time to time and made the occasional note on the pad in front of him. "I'd also like the plastic tube placed in a strong box for the time being. The key to the box should be handed over to Mr. Al-Obeidi when, and only when, you've received the full payment by wire transfer. The money should then be deposited in my number 3 account in your Zurich branch. And are you able to tell me the exact sum you anticipate receiving from Mr. Al-Obeidi?" asked the banker. $90 million, said Cavalli. The banker didn't raise an eyebrow. The archivist looked up the name of the Commerce Secretary in his government directory, then picked up his phone and pressed one button. 482-2000 was now programmed into his speed dial.
"Department of Commerce. Dick Fielding, please."
"Just a moment."
"Office of the Director. This is Secretary Brown."
The archivist had to wait only a few seconds before the call was put through.
"Good morning, Mr. Secretary," said an alert voice. "Good morning, Mr. Fielding. This is Calder Marshall, Archivist of the United States of America." "I thought..." "You thought?" "I guess they must have misunderstood. How may I help you, Mr. Marshall?" "I am trying to trace a former employee of yours, Rex Butterworth."
"I can't help you on that one."
"Why? Are you also bound by the Privacy Act?"
Fielding laughed. "I only wish I was."
"I don't understand," said the archivist.
"Last week we sent Butterworth a merit bonus and it was returned. No forwarding address."
"But he has a wife."
"She got the same response to her last letter."
"And his mother in South Carolina?"
"She's been dead for years."
"Thank you," said Calder Marshall, and put the phone down.
He knew exactly whom he had to call next. Dumont AC is one of Geneva's more modern banking establishments, having been founded as late as 1781. Since then, the bank has spent over 200 years handling other people's money without religious or racial prejudice. Dumont AC had always been willing to deal with Arab sheikh or Jewish businessman, Nazi Gauleiter or British aristocrat, in fact, anyone who required their services. It was a policy that had always reaped dividends in every trading currency throughout the world. The bank occupied 12 floors of a building just off the Place de la Fusterie. The meeting that had been arranged that Tuesday at noon was scheduled to take place in the boardroom on the 11th floor, the floor below the chairman's office. The chairman of the bank, Pierre Dumont, had held his present position for the past 19 years, but even he had rarely experienced a more unlikely coupling than that between an educated Arab from Iraq and the son of a former mafia lawyer from New York. The boardroom table could seat 16, but on this occasion it was only occupied by 4. Pierre Dumont sat in the center of one of the long sides under a portrait of his uncle, the former chairman, François Dumont. The present chairman wore a dark suit of elegant cut and style that would not have looked out of place had it been worn by any of the chairmen of the 48 banks located within a square mile of the building. His shirt was of a shade of blue that was not influenced by Milan fashions, and his tie was so discreet that, moments after leaving the room, only a remarkably observant client would have been able to recall its color or pattern. On Monsieur Dumont's right sat his client, Mr. Al-Obeidi, whose dress, although slightly more fashionable, was nonetheless equally conservative. Opposite Monsieur Dumont sat the chairman of Franchard ici, who, any observer would have noticed, must have shared the same tailor as Monsieur Dumont. On Franchard's left sat Antonio Cavalli, wearing a double-breasted Armani suit, making him look as if he had dropped in on the wrong meeting. The little carriage clock that sat on the Louis-Philippe mantelpiece behind Monsieur Dumont completed 12 strokes. The chairman cleared his throat and began the proceedings. "Gentlemen, the purpose of this meeting, which was called at our instigation but with your agreement, is to exchange a rare document for an agreed sum of money." Monsieur Dumont pushed his half-moon spectacles further up his nose. "Naturally, I must begin, Mr. Cavalli, by asking if you are in possession of that document." "No, he is not, sir," interjected Monsieur Franchard, as prearranged with Cavalli, "because he has entrusted the document's safekeeping to our bank. But I can confirm that as soon as the agreed sum has been transferred, I have been given power of attorney to release the document immediately."
"But that is not what we agreed," interrupted Dumont, who leaned forward, feigning shock, before adding, "My client's government has no intention of paying another penny without full scrutiny of the document. You agreed to deliver it here by midday, and in any case we still have to be convinced of its authenticity."
"That is understood by my client," said Monsieur Franchard. "Indeed, you are most welcome to attend my office at any time convenient to you in order to carry out such an inspection. Following that inspection, the moment you have transferred the agreed amount, the document will be released."
"This is all very well," countered Monsieur Dumont, pushing his half-moon spectacles back up his nose. "But your client has failed to keep to his original agreement, which, in my view, allows my client's government," he emphasized the word government, "to reconsider its position."
"My client felt it prudent under the circumstances to protect his interest by depositing the document in his own bank for safekeeping," came back the immediate reply from Monsieur Franchard. Anyone watching the two bankers sparring with each other might have been surprised to learn that they played chess together every Saturday night, which Monsieur Franchard invariably won, and tennis after lunch on Sunday, which he regularly lost.
"I cannot accept this new arrangement," said Al-Obeidi, speaking for the first time. "My government has charged me to pay only a further $40 million if the original agreement is breached in any way."
"But this is ridiculous," said Cavalli, his voice rising with every word. "We are quibbling over a matter of a few hours at the most, and a building less than half a mile away. And as you well know, the figure agreed on was $90 million.
"But you have since broken our agreement," said Al-Obeidi, "so the original terms can no longer be considered valid by my government."
"No $90 million, no document," said Cavalli, banging his fist on the table.
"Let us be realistic, Mr. Cavalli," said Al-Obeidi. "The document is no longer of any use to you, and I have a feeling you would have settled for $50 million in the first place."
"That is not the—"
Monsieur Franchard touched Cavalli's arm.
"I would like a few minutes alone with my client."
"Of course," said Monsieur Dumont, rising from his place. "We will leave you. Please press the button under the table the moment you wish us to return."
Monsieur Dumont and his client left the room without another word. "He's bluffing," said Cavalli. "He'll pay, I know it."
"I don't think so," said Franchard.
"What makes you say that?"
"The use of the words 'my government'